Project Lawful aka Plane Crash by Yarwane aka Eliezer Yudkowsky and Lynn Tamande. My fun research project has more existential risk than I anticipated. Episode 121.
So this whole question, Keltham admits, is not something he has actually given much thought before. There is, of course, no standard rationale, you're told in civilization, for why the keepers and governance couldn't possibly be corrupt. That would be ridiculous in the light of elementary security reasoning. Obviously, if you're inside a dark conspiracy, any standard rationale like that you get will be corrupt. Any Dath Ilani who wants to reason this out should do that on their own, or with a few personally known trusted friends, obviously. Probably even a dark conspiracy wouldn't think it could get away with having standard social beliefs and arguments about how they couldn't possibly be ruling society from the shadows. Individuals would be smart enough to reinvent the incredibly simple argument from security mindset about how no such standard arguments should exist, and that actually would be a giveaway. It's an unduly fascinating question, which Keltham should really extract himself from, and he get back to his original intended lecture topic, which was the forms of governance. He's totally not going to do that, and we'll go on talking about this anyways. So, on a few moments' first reflection, it seems to Keltham that estimating the probability of civilization being run by a dark conspiracy boils down to, 1. The question of whether civilization's apparently huge efforts to build anti-dark conspiracy citizens constitute sincere work that makes the dark conspiracy's life harder, or fake work designed to only look like that. And, 2. The prior probability that the keepers and governance would have arrived on the scene already corrupted during the last major reorganization of civilization a few decades ago. Keltham basically doesn't think it's possible for criminal sociopaths to take over keepers and governance that start out actually functioning the way they currently claim to function, nor for criminal conspirators to successfully conceal a major conspiracy from a functional society not run in toto by that conspiracy. With respect to point one, Keltham would first like to observe that a tyranny like this, he uses the Tal'Dane term tyranny, it's shorter and feels like it has more of the right connotations than the nearest baseline term. Doesn't seem like it could most effectively secure its power by electing to construct a veneer of civilization and hiding behind that. Where that veneer involves raising the non-conspiracy kids, knowing enough law that they won't submit to threats, want to overthrow conspiracies, and know mathematical protocols they can personally verify that sure seem apparently useful for overthrowing conspiracies. A more sensible tyranny should try to have a population of technically literate but obedient order followers, frightened of retribution, knowing how to do chemistry but not knowing the law of decision theory, whereby they could try to coordinate with each other, or that would make it obvious they should ignore threats. Law knowers who start out in a world of threatenable people, which makes it be not a threat, but only the ordinary optimal strategy for the tyranny to kill any law knowers, will find it obvious that they should conceal their knowledge and wait for opportunities to strike. But civilization is a whole society of law knowers, and those will find it obvious that they should all coordinate in shouting, "Now!" and ignore threats past that point. This seems, to Keltham, like not the optimal way to arrange a tyranny that wants to hold power and exercise as much power as possible. Such a tyranny should restrict knowledge of law to a tiny clique of the smartest people who are allowed to know how the law of coordination works. It should run heredity optimization at a level where it's not trying to make the average people as smart as an average Dath Ilani, so people aren't smart enough to correctly rebuild broken decision theories that their society educated them with. The median Dath Ilani on the current system probably is smart enough to do that, reinvent the basic results of correct decision theory, if maybe not all the math, even if the rest of society is telling them to use a broken decision theory instead. So maybe more like intelligence 14 than intelligence 16, 17. Then the tyrants form a separate breeding group with heredity optimization for much higher thinkumph, the equivalent of wizards with headbands compared to intelligence 10 people. This obviously is not what civilization looks like. Keltham can observe that just from direct introspection on how smart he is and how much stuff he knows.
Is that what the successful Ilani Cheliaks will look like? She doesn't actually like it, but that might be a personal deficit. A lack of appreciation for tyranny, where it comes from limiting what people have the chance to learn and realize. She is pretty sure that the kind of tyranny that suits her personally is the kind where everyone gets a decent education and can then rise as far as their strength will take them, landing in the place they deserve. But she can see how that would be much harder to actually implement than keeping most people confused and ignorant. But surely, if you were a Dathylani tyrant, with all their resources, you could do the thing you actually preferred most.
Suppose that Keltham is wrong about his point one. Suppose that the optimal strategy for a tyranny in full control is indeed for some reason to hide behind a veneer of civilization full of costly signals of non-conspiracy and disobedient people like Keltham. Under this assumption, the optimal strategy for a dark conspiracy looks like what you think civilization is supposed to look like, and therefore the two cases are not distinguishable by observation. Then we have to consider the prior before evidence, which means considering the question of how you'd end up with a dark conspiracy in charge in the first place, and how likely those scenarios look compared to governance uncorrupted. To Keltham, it looks pretty impossible for an existing, well-functioning structure of keepers and governance to be taken over by infiltrating criminals, because, like, the keepers and governance have considered that. Some people out there are having so much fun making sure that no small group of criminals can take over the keepers and governance. It would take unshared magic and mind control, and even then, Keltham isn't sure it could work. They game things like that. They wouldn't be unprepared. There will be cutouts and warning signs and hidden counter-conspiratorial groups. One of the alien invasion rehearsal festivals had the aliens taking over every network-connected computer in civilization simultaneously. Governance runs prep like that, but more of it. So, plowing ahead quickly on this reasoning and thinking things through out loud, it seems to Keltham that the main way you get corrupted keepers and governance is not by criminals successfully infiltrating and taking over some earlier system that looked a lot like uncorrupted keepers and governance. There must be some corrupted earlier system that is run by criminals in toto, and which then, hypothetically, builds a more sophisticated system of corrupted keepers and governance to even more strongly hold power while looking even more to the rest of civilization like it's totally not that. At this point, Keltham wants to deploy some sort of inductive argument from people doing, like, the obvious stuff they ought to do at every historical point along the way. A high-functioning society that isn't corrupt to start with will have some well-calibrated estimate of how much its pre-governance can be trusted, how robust they are to various kinds of criminal infiltration. If a government looks like something that it's possible for clever criminals to take over, you won't give that government the sort of powers that criminals could use to entrench themselves, obviously. Galarian has these kinds of problems because Galarian has wizards and clerics. Because 1,000 people are most of a country's combat potential. Criminals rule in Galarian because ordinary people can't stop them, not because ordinary people could have totally stopped them, but decided not to for some reason. You shouldn't expect to see the same phenomenon in a non-magical world.
It doesn't seem very obvious that without magic, weapons technology turns out such that ordinary people could stop any government they didn't like. And, well, usually when people try that, it's not that they fail so much as that decades of bloodshed ensue.
Okay, but to be blunt here, point the first, have they tried that literally without magic in a world where magic has never existed to give rise in the first place to horrible governments where a few people are in charge of everybody else? Because why would non-magical people ever do that in the first place? Point the second, Keltham doesn't know how Galarian ended up with average intelligence 10. That one seventh circle wizard Keltham talked to at the Worldwound thought it might have something to do with Earthfall, but maybe at intelligence 10 people actually are stupid enough to put a few people in charge of everyone else, and then too stupid to ever manage to get together and come up with something else, which is not that. However, at average intelligence 14, or whatever it was before Dathylon's nascent pre-civilization figured out natural selection and heredity optimization and started deliberately increasing think-coomph further. You can probably invent and run policy prediction markets, maybe just a few of them, without computers to do lots of calculations in a golem-like fashion, but some. And then the policy prediction markets can tell you which actions will have which consequences when it comes to trying a different government system or different strategies for forming one. Frankly, it does not seem to Keltham that you should need policy prediction markets to avoid decades of bloodshed ensuing, especially if it has happened more than once. You should be able to have everyone get together and decide to do something else, which is not that. But with policy prediction markets, you can definitely do it. Anybody who makes an incorrect prediction about how to form a new government will lose money.
This really seems too optimistic, but they admittedly haven't lived in a world that would try it.
That policy prediction market business sounds kind of important, actually. Can you possibly say how those work?
Shouldn't take long. Keltham would have needed to explain those to explain governance anyways. A prediction market is when lots of people bet on something observable, instead of it being a bet between just two people. Let's say that a prediction share pays out 1 gold, 100 copper, if it rains at any time tomorrow, or pays out 0 copper otherwise. Then Alice can say, I'll sell up to 1,000 shares of rain tomorrow for 60 copper each, if she thinks the probability of rain tomorrow is noticeably under 60%, and Bob can wander up and say, sure, I'll buy 500 of those at 60. If he thinks the probability of rain tomorrow is noticeably over 60%. And then if some clouds show up at evening today, Carl says, I'll buy your 500 shares at 75, and Bob thinks that 75 sounds around right to him, so he sells his shares to Carl and pockets a 15 copper profit per share. Blah blah market makers hang around and sell or buy based on technical market trends about what the public information looks like, instead of on the basis of having private information, so people can buy into the prediction markets at only very slight premiums, even if nobody else has private information right then. Blah blah, you can subsidize a market by saying you're willing to buy or sell at your starting estimate of 60%, or whatever. And then anybody who disagrees with you about that in either direction will wander up and buy or sell from you. Blah blah. This is a very simple automatic market-making algorithm. If somebody wants to subsidize a market continuously and isn't worried about losing a bunch of copper whenever it rains out, blah blah, you can ask a bunch of separate questions for what's the chance X happens if we do this or this or this. You only end up doing one thing, Y. The market on does X happen if we do Y pays out 1 gold if X happens. All other markets are negated, and everybody gets back their original investment, as it was kept in some standard store of value like equity in a huge basket of well-known corporations. Civilization aggregates votes into delegates, then electors, then representatives, then legislators. Legislators negotiate among themselves about what civilization wants to have happen. They debate arguments from very serious people about which observables to measure to get at unobservable outcomes. The actual step of predicting which policies yield which observables is done by a policy prediction market. Then, usually, the legislators do whatever's predicted, with the highest probability to lead to observables that seem like they should strongly tie to a good actual outcome. Unless the best policy, according to the market, looks like it'll have bad effects for which nobody has figured out how to predict observable correlates, which, like, does ever happen, but causes a lot of very serious people to start shrieking angrily at the legislators and each other about civilizational inadequacy. A few years or sometimes decades later, the observables come in, and the prediction market on the action actually taken pays out. The point being, it's not the job of civilization's leaders to foresee the future. Answering, what happens if we do this, is the job of all of civilization, including whoever's currently closest to being like Nimmimal. Answering, but what results do we even want, really, is more the job of the top level of governance. Incidentally, if there was actually a dark conspiracy in Dathilan, they'd have to be messing with the prediction market results in order to make sure their own preferred actions got taken, presumably by making all the other actions not taken look worse, rather than having the taken action look better, so that people didn't notice the actual actions taken were resulting in systematically off predictions. So basically all the major market makers in prediction markets and all the home traders would have to be in on the conspiracy, since otherwise they'd notice something off about the market movements they were obsessively watching all day. Once Project Lawful gets to the point where anybody besides Keltham knows anything about prestidigitation chemistry and spell silver mining, and once they've got more experiments they're considering trying than they have the resources to try, Project Lawful will obviously set up and subsidize an internal prediction market on which chemistry experiments will pan out.
Asmodia asked literally yesterday how to aggregate lots of people's different predictions for who will Keltham try dating next into a single estimate, and was fobbed off with some simplistic rules about writing down a series of estimates on a sheet of paper tacked onto a wall.
Kids usually do start with that before they buy into prediction markets.
Asmodia is not a kid. She is a second circle wizard with 18 intelligence and a +6 wisdom headband who is headed for the world wound, and starting this evening, she is going to run an actual fucking prediction market about who Keltham tries dating next, so that Project Lawful has any experience with doing this correctly before they have to use prediction markets to decide between expensive spell silver mining experiments.
Okay.
Asmodia? Is Alter Asmodia this invested in this?
Sorry. If Alter Asmodia wasn't this invested before, she is now. Well, Alter Asmodia having visible, tendencies about things was going to happen somehow.
Apology accepted. It's fine to care about things. Now, to return to the more somber topic, there's a loophole in the logic saying that, in non-magical societies, the rest of the world can outfight the world's military. Economically underscore scalable weapons. The class of weaponry where you can just go on spending more money if you want the weapons to be even more destructive. Once those kinds of weapons are invented, a handful of people could, in principle, cow all the rest, if those other people submitted to threats. The last time civilization underwent a major reorganization, a few decades ago, it was being reorganized out of something that already had scalable weapons, since there's no record since then of scalable weapons having been discovered for the first time. You could imagine that this reorganization was a cover for a dark conspiracy that already ruled everything, to set up keepers and governance that it controlled. And then it hid away all the history books, suggesting that things had ever been different. And then, apparently, taught everybody not to submit to threats, once they were hiding. This, by assumption, apparently, is totally the best course of action for them to hold on to power. They should build a fake civilization and hide behind that? Great idea. The best idea. Even the smartest dark conspiracy can't think of any better ones. But again, one must ask, how did this dark conspiracy arise in the first place? How likely is the most likely historical pathway for that compared to historical pathways that lead to governance uncorrupted? By the time a society is able to build complicated, expensive, powerful, non-magical weapons that a handful of people could use to outfight the rest, this society should have had, decades earlier, centuries earlier, far more than enough mathematical sophistication to run a paper cryptographic underscore protocol. That probably didn't translate, and Keltham should probably try to describe in any case some of the actual countermeasures that civilization is known to have in its arsenal against dark conspiracies. So, a few decades ago, if the history books Keltham has read are not all fake, governance, in whatever form it existed in that time, said that it needed to do something incredibly suspicious-looking and not explain why. Whatever civilization then existed said roughly, okay, fine, but we're going to go to some extreme lengths to try to make sure you can't benefit from doing that for bad reasons. The entire current government got fired and barred from politics permanently. Then literally everyone old enough to do correct extended arithmetic participated in the equivalent of an enormous public coin spin, using calculations carried out by hand on paper and transmitted from person to person by in-person handoff, carrying out a mathematical process whose mathematical properties any adult could verify. No machines were used, no instant communication devices, because you couldn't trust the machine makers to not be in the dark conspiracy. Any such machines would be a single vulnerable point for the dark conspiracy to attack. This algorithm selected new random leaders from among everybody who wanted to be eligible for the new project, in charge of rebooting governance from scratch. Any non-random or popularity-based election process might be something a pre-existing conspiracy could get control of and exploit, not by faking the results, but by steering people to vote for conspiracy candidates, in a paper cryptographic underscore protocol, Like that, you and your trusted friends could theoretically be inside a bubble, surface formed of all of your friends' friends, who are all in the conspiracy, and working together to fake all of your inputs and discard all of your outputs. But from most people's perspective, this should be unlikely. The conspiracy would need to include all of your friends that you randomly selected, or all of your randomly selected friends would need to have all of their randomly selected friends in the conspiracy. You can basically prove, using a protocol like this, that the only way for the conspiracy to fake your results, selecting the interim political leadership, is if you and all of your friends are inside an enclosed bubble that the conspiracy runs. And this is possible, but not likely. The only technology you need to run this process is paper ink, writing, and math that 95% of Daath Ilani adults can understand. A society should be able to do that long before it can build really powerful non-magical weapons, of the sort that a few people could use to threaten the rest of the world into submission, even in a Galarian-like world of people who submitted to threats. So, when weapons like that are invented, a non-magical society should already have a trustworthy government in place to handle the possibilities implied by those weapons. If they're not already very sure their government isn't a dark conspiracy, they can reboot the government using a paper cryptographic underscore protocol before they let the government build any weapons like that. And before scalable weapons are invented, the non-magical citizens can directly outfight a non-magical military just by outnumbering it, because the military can't just use bigger and bigger weapons to fight back. Keltham realizes they've grown up in Galarian, where governments are terrible. But this is a phenomenon produced by the existence and misuse of magic that hugely concentrates military power into a few people, not something you should expect to see in non-magical worlds like Keltham's. Why would a non-magical world put up with being openly ruled by grimdark criminal sociopaths if they could collectively outfight their rulers? And if a non-magical world couldn't arrive at justified confidence of its governance not being a giant hidden dark conspiracy, why wouldn't it just reboot its governance using randomly selected volunteers and a paper cryptographic underscore protocol? This argument seems like it should be valid at every historical point, up to the invention of scalable weapons. And obviously you would, at that point, reboot governance just to be sure. Keltham does admit that the main hole in this entire argument is sort of obviously the keepers, who can't clearly be rebooted in the same way as governance, because you can't just appoint random people to be able to do the sort of things that keepers do. At least in theory, keepers aren't allowed live weapons, except under direct government supervision checked by randomized volunteers, because, like, super obvious precautions, yo. But the keepers have talk control. And maybe the meta-keepers aren't being honest about training governance upper echelons to resist talk control. If that's true, it's not something you can fix by rebooting governance. So, yeah, if Keltham's world is run by a secret dark conspiracy, it's sort of obviously the keepers, and they're doing it by repeatedly talk controlling all the new leaders who get delegated. Call it 2%. Because if they were actually doing that, they wouldn't just warn people that talk control was a thing. Yes, even taking into account that maybe that's exactly what they want you to think, they still wouldn't just tell you. It's like how, if the Chelish Dark Conspiracy orchestrated the whole weird thing with Asmodaya to try to scare Keltham out of ever asking to try on an artifact headband, they would actually just not tell Keltham about intelligence headbands being a thing in the first place. In the Daath Ilan being run by hypothetical corrupted keepers, the rest of the world wouldn't know that law was a thing. It would be run by a secret elite of law users. Everybody else would just, like, not know any math. Or only know about math as something you could use for engineering bridges and not know that some kinds of math could be used to organize your thoughts better. Or, if they did have any concept of law, they'd be introduced only to some corrupted version of decision theory, which claimed that the lawful thing to do was give in to threats and accept offers of one copper piece in the ultimatum game and not bother to vote in elections. And pre-programmed with some sort of canned reply to anybody who presented them with better decision theory about how getting higher payoffs in dilemmas was like totally not what decision theory was really about. And only selecting particular decisions a particular way was truly lawful, even if agents like that systematically and predictably in advance got lower payoffs. Okay, maybe this part isn't so plausible as a consistent world.
Talk control could work better on people who know keepers can do talk control somehow.
The keepers could have some form of mind control that isn't like the one they're showing you, working by a totally different method, like magic. And what they're showing you is so that if anybody else discovers the real magic of Dathilan, people say, oh, that must be talk control and alert a keeper.
Or, Maritzel said, there could be people in on the conspiracy who'd be uncomfortable with hiding the entire concept of talk control, but are willing to agree to various uses of it so long as they aren't lying about the fact keepers can do that.
Or the talk control thing could have been publicized before the conspiracy took hold?
It's definitely not that last one. The keepers could just announce that knowing about talk control had turned socially info-hazardous and have the knowledge not get passed down to the next generation. Asterisk. Social info-hazard lit. Exfo-hazard. Information that conveys ordinary positive advantage to individuals who know it, but has net negative value to society because of how that knowledge affects people around them. E.g., exact knowledge of how to construct scalable weaponry cheaply would be an ordinary advantage to an individual who knew it, but disadvantageous to everyone to have everyone know. Strongly distinguished from the much weirder case of individual info hazards, like spoilers for a movie you were eagerly anticipating and haven't watched yet.
How can you describe that much power and be sure no one is misusing it? The upsetting thing is that for all she knows, maybe Dathilani really are like that.
And if there are, per Maritzel, people within the conspiracy who are only okay with talk control being used for restricted purposes, so long as civilization in general is told and warned about it existing. That sounds exactly like how the keepers are supposed to be. Like, that's not even a hidden non-dark conspiracy, that's just what the keepers are supposed to regularly do. Hide dangerous knowledge and only use it for sufficiently important purposes. Obviously, there ought to be somebody whose job it is to do that. Why would they need to hide in a sensible society that recognized the reason for their existence? They could just go out in the open and be like, yo, we're the keepers. Anybody who would otherwise need to start a conspiracy to hide dangerous information for good reasons and only use it well and properly can just come to us instead. We'll handle it for you and probably give you a substantial reporting bonus. That's exactly what the keepers are. They're the non-dark conspiracy. A world only needs one of those. Two of them would just get in each other's way.
Right, but if they're also doing some things Keltham wouldn't approve of, but that they think is acceptable, that'd look exactly like this, right?
He's sure the keepers are doing some things Keltham wouldn't approve of? The question is whether they're knowingly doing things that civilization in aggregate wouldn't approve of, or that practically nobody in civilization at large would approve of, even if they knew everything else the keepers knew and could reason as clearly as keepers could. And if the keepers make a habit of doing that and secretly run everything to cover that up, the rest of civilization shouldn't be, like, teaching children how to coordinate against dark conspiracies and break out of false realities and fight the hypothetical corrupted governance military.
Yeah, that does seem like a weird thing for them to do. So, 2%.
The chance that Cheliax has some kind of dark conspiracy going on is a lot higher than that, Gregoria says dryly.
Ione and Carissa did have some persuasive arguments, though, about talk control working better if people know it exists. That's already known to be true for a lesser case of talk control called hypnosis, though that only works on very few people, which is sad because it's so fascinating and so useful for the few people who are hypnotizable, or talk control actually being a cover for some other form of magic. Even taking that into account, though, basically Keltham's brain is reporting that it's not convinced here. Dathilan is too nice of a place to live, even for weird people like Keltham who disagree with it. Civilization trains its children too thoroughly to be able to fight dark conspiracies and hypothetical corrupted governance. Maybe call it 2.5% instead of 2% pending consideration of some of the points raised here. Cheliax obviously seems like it'd have some dark conspiracies. Heck, Dathilan probably has some dark conspiracies. The question is whether those dark conspiracies are running everything unbeknownst to Abigail Thrun, or Aspexia Rugatone, or Contessa Larilatha, which would be a lot more likely of tropes, in fact. So, good thing it's currently looking like no tropes.
No tropes seems really great. Does saying that bring down the tropes?
Only if they exist. Anyways, Keltham should get back to his lecture on governance. Keltham was supposed to start by telling them all to use their presumably civilization-trained skill of perspective-taking of ignorance to envision a hypothetical world where nothing resembling coordination had started to happen yet. Since, after all, you wouldn't want your thoughts about the best possible forms of civilization to cognitively anchor on what already existed. You can imagine starting in a world where all the same stuff and technology from present civilization exists, since the question faced is what form of governance is best suited to a world like that one. Alternatively, imagine an alternative form of the exercise involving people fresh born into a fresh world where nothing has yet been built, and everybody's just wandering around over a grassy plain. Either way, you should assume that everybody knows all about decision theory and cooperation-defection dilemmas. The question being asked is not, what form of governance would we invent if we were stupid? Civilization could then begin. Maybe it wouldn't actually happen exactly that way, but it is nonetheless said as though in stories. Civilization could then begin again, when people envisioned running out of stored food a couple of years later. Standing around all these beautiful, complicated machines that people remembered how to operate, but required multiple people working together to operate, which nobody was yet incentivized to operate. Or civilization could begin for the first time when the hypothetical, newly created, educated people imagined trying to build shelters for themselves or sow food plants to grow, and thought to themselves that there would be less point in doing that if others would just move into the shelters as soon as they walked away, or eat the crops that they had sown. And people then would say to themselves, what if we tried something else which is not that?
It begins with the idea of coordinating it all. Cooperation, simultaneous action, that two people can work a machine that requires two people to operate. It begins with the hypothetical, newly created, educated people, simultaneously hunting a large prey animal. A stag, perhaps, that requires multiple hunters to bring it down relatively safely. It begins with multiple individuals aggregating as if into a larger compound agent, a macro agent which can choose among all its available compound actions in the cross product of the action space, instead of individuals choosing as if in isolation and expecting others to do the same. There is then, of course, the problem of lawfully dividing the gains, when the macro agent dissolves back into individuals to individually consume those gains. But this is a matter of law, and the people do remember law. It continues into a new problem, the problem of motivating such socially useful actions as producing food, for if nobody does this, soon nobody will eat. You can imagine lesser solutions, collective farming of collectively guarded fields, monitors on hard work, and rewards of food access, but these are simultaneously too simplistic and overcomplicated, the very opposite of an elegant solution. People can work harder, invest more effort, for a usually monotonically increasing reward, a function operated directly by the environment, by physical law. There just needs to be some system whereby, when people work, they are themselves the ones to benefit from it. But this requires a far more complicated form of coordinated action, something that bounded agents lack the computational power to consider as a giant macro action of their collective agent. The optimal macro strategy must be lossily projected down into simplified mental rules for individuals, a notion of imaginary ownership tagging. If one person sows food plants within a field and waters them and protects them, everybody around them will behave as if the resulting food crop is tagged with an imaginary pointer to that person, saying that the food may be consumed by them alone, or only consumed by those others the food's owner designates, at their own decision. That seems like it should obviously be an option built into the system too. And once you create an imaginary structure of coordinated action that elegantly complicated, the consequences and further required features inevitably explode. The explosion that results is civilization's basic form nearly in toto. People could often benefit from other people doing various things for them, but they must, of course, do something for the other in exchange. If things have socially constructed tags pointing to people, who alone may use or consume those things? Why not let people announce that the pointer now points to someone else? That's one way of doing something in return. For somebody who did some task for you, that was easier for them than for you. If fields can be owned, and an owned field produces owned produce in the future, why not let people announce that some of the future produce can point to some other owner? Often, the announcements of changed imaginary ownership are meant to be traded, executed one in exchange for another. Then a new version and feature expansion of the system can eliminate the uncertainty about whether the other will announce their bargained ownership change. After you announce yours, imaginary contracts that molecularize the atomic actions into a transaction that executes simultaneously on both sides, only after both sides announce the same contract. Do people want to work on some larger endeavor, specialize in different aspects of farming, and collectively challenge a larger farm? Let the tags in the eyes of society point to persistent imaginary constructs specified in some contract specification language. A corporation is one such persistent contract. Let this system expand, let people use it enough, and there will predictably come a point where there aren't lots of untagged resources nearby for somebody to tag in society's eyes. Once there are not plenty of new plots of land to tag and farm, people may indeed begin to ask, why should this land be owned by them and not me because they did some work on that land? If that's the rule, then won't people who foresee the predictable scarcity later run around trying to plough small, shallow furrows through every potential field within the reach of running, trying to tag as much land as pointing to themselves as possible? And when all that land has been used up, wouldn't the people who were slower runners and didn't end up with any land, wouldn't new children born into this world for that matter, ask themselves, and perhaps ask out loud, if this elaborate imaginary social construct doesn't offer me any benefits for going along with the pretense, if the system says that little or nothing has an imaginary tag pointing to me, then in what sense is this even coordination from my perspective? Why would I cooperate in the coordinated rule of not eating things tagged as pointing to others if the result is that there's nothing for me to eat? Where's my fair share of the rewards for playing along with this pretend game, for cooperating with what this imaginary tagging system says is my part and my action in it?
This concept, incidentally, took some arguments to persuade into Tiny Keltham when he was first hearing about all this. Tiny Keltham had a very strong instinctive sense that objects just were owned by people, and that what made a system fair and right was entirely that only the people who owned objects could do anything with them or transfer them to other people. It was hard for Tiny Keltham, at first, to see past his instinctive suspicion that people asking, "What's my reward for cooperating with this system?" were about to use that as an excuse to storm onto his hypothetical farm and eat his food that he'd worked to produce, and call that their share, without doing any work themselves. Older children's attempted arguments about "put yourself into that other person's shoes" repeatedly failed on Keltham, who kept replying that he wouldn't take anybody else's stuff, period. But Tiny Keltham was eventually persuaded, by a watcher then, not by an older child, by the argument that it is an internally consistent imaginary tagging system to say that some single person, Elsbeth, owns all the land in the world. Everybody else has to work those lands and give Elsbeth a share of anything that grows there, since by default it would just end up tagged as hers, unless they agree to pay half their gains to her. The question then becomes, why should anybody else except Elsbeth play along with this imaginary system once it gets to that point? Why shouldn't everyone who isn't Elsbeth all just wake up out of this bad dream and do something else which is not that? Keltham asked if maybe the system had started out with everybody owning an equal amount of land, but Elsbeth had been a really clever asset trader, and ended up owning everything in the world after a series of voluntary transactions. In which case, it seemed to him that fair was fair. The Watcher told Keltham that, even if the last generation had gotten the world into that state through a series of voluntary transactions, the children born into it might look around and see that no land was tagged to them, that everything was tagged to Elsbeth. They would ask what they were receiving in exchange for playing along with that particular delusion, and why they should not imagine some other tagging system instead, in which their coordinated action in playing along would actually receive any reciprocal benefit or reward. And Tiny Keltham growled and stomped around for a while, but finally conceded that, fine, the pointers were imaginary, and yes, it took more than just a consistent tagging system running on strictly voluntary transactions to make the whole thing be fair or right. The elegant core structure was necessary, but not sufficient.
The unimproved land, the raw resources, these things must be tagged with ownership for the owners to have an incentive to improve them. It doesn't mean that this tagging need be considered as free to the new owner. Discard the obvious first solution that is wrong, of charging somebody an amount of food or other worked goods, to tag previously untagged land, and redistributing those payments equally among everyone in the world. Even leaving aside the question of how that system initially starts farming anything at all, it inevitably arrives at a point where there's no untagged land left, or it's impossibly expensive, whereupon the next generation of children, being born with no land tagged to them and no payments for newly bought land coming in, will again begin to ask, why should I play along with this imaginary arrangement at all? Where's my payoff for coordinating my action with yours? More sensible, then, to regard people as renting land and other raw resource sources, at their unimproved price, of course, but still an unimproved price set by competitive bidding, albeit perhaps for long-term leases, etc. When you are born, you conceptually acquire a share in this whole system.
Of course, Tiny Keltham immediately demanded his accumulated profits from his share of all the land rents in the world, and demanded also to know why he had never been told about this before. The Watcher again had to be brought in to explain to Keltham that, conceptually speaking, his share was mostly going into maintaining a lot of non-rival, non-excludable goods, or services that civilization thought should be provided to literally everyone, even if in principle they weren't public goods. The value of unimproved land wasn't as high as Keltham was imagining in the first place. Doth Ilan still had whole forests just lying around, not being used for anything. Tiny Keltham said that he had absolutely not consented for his share of the land rents to be used for non-rival, non-excludable anything, and from now on he wanted it delivered to him in the form of actual money he could spend on what he wanted. "Could he please wait and listen to the whole story before getting angry?" said the Watcher. Tiny Keltham was incredibly suspicious, but he did already have a great deal of experience with adult craziness turning out to be more reasonable than he had at first thought. Tiny Keltham agreed to go on listening for a while longer. Then, before he started trying to persuade all the other children that they ought to band together and overthrow civilization to get their fair share of the land rents in the form of actual money delivered to them right now.
Because, you see, it was said to Tiny Keltham, returning to the hypothetical newly created educated people, at some point their system is going to grow large enough that even with everybody receiving benefits for their participation in the system, there will still be defectors. There will be people who just don't want to go along with the system and try to eat food with a tag on it that points to somebody else. Now, the nascent civilization needs police that can outfight any individual thief. And since newly created educated people aren't stupid, they know they obviously need to ensure that the collective of all of them can always outfight the police. Neither of these features are cheap, and neither easily lend themselves to private ownership.
Tiny Keltham said that he'd be happy to pay for the police to protect him out of his share of the land rent once it was being paid to him in actual money. And he didn't see why governance had to take his money and use it without his permission, supposedly, to protect him with police. Why couldn't people just pay for police who sold their services on the market like everybody else? Or if it was much more efficient to police larger regions at once, why couldn't his sub-city in default provide police, and then Keltham would help his parents pay their share of the house rent out of his share of the land rent being paid to him directly?
Because the police have weapons, Tiny Keltham. What if the police for a sub-city decide one day that, in this sub-city, it's fine to raise kids of Keltham's age and force them to work in exchange for only enough food to keep them alive? What if the police decide that nobody in the city block is allowed to hire different police and take all their stuff to make sure they can't afford them? What if somebody dies and their head doesn't get cooled and preserved fast enough? That's the kind of thing that civilization as a whole has to prevent, as a universal regulation with no opt-outs, so it doesn't happen anywhere in civilization. Even if you thought people should be able to opt out of any and every protection as adults, you'd still have to check to make sure they weren't having kids In fact, Tiny Keltham, your sub-city does contract with a police agency to do a lot of ordinary policing, and it does appear in your parents' rent on the foundation for their house module. But governance has to provide oversight of that policing, and that costs money. Cryosuspension, emergency response on constant standby service costs money. Protecting the waiting ones in their frozen sleep costs money. Maintaining the election system to pick people to run the government that regulates armed police costs money. Quiet cities to host the 5% of people who can't be happy working in civilization and who are thus held injured by what civilization has chosen to become cost actually quite a lot of money. No, most people won't need the quiet option, but everyone, when they're born, can be considered as needing an insurance policy against that happening to them, and that insurance policy costs money. Subsidized policy, prediction underscore markets to make all those institutions work boundedly, optimally cost money. When you add up everything like that, which governance has to do for everyone, or can't just sell to individuals separately, it actually does eat all the rent of unimproved land, plus all of governance's other revenue streams. Lots of individual philanthropists fund governance on top of that, so that civilization can have a bigger government than basic rents alone will support, so that there can be annual alien invasion rehearsal festivals, say, or so that quiet cities can have nicer things. Most philanthropies in civilization with room for more funding accomplish roughly the same amount of marginal good per marginal labor hour, according to most people's utility functions. If you've got a fairly conventional philanthropic utility function, you get to pick whichever random charity or impact certificate market best matches your personal taste there, including just throwing your money at governance. It's like buying individual stock equity investments. There's more volatility, but all the expected returns are the same. In civilization, that is.
Tiny Keltham demanded to see the actual accounts of which essential public services, his share of the land rent, was getting spent on. He was promptly provided them in easy-to-read format for children with lots of helpful pictures. Lots of Dath Elani children demand to see those accounts at some point. With great focus and concentration, Tiny Keltham managed to read through 22 pages of that before getting bored and running off to play. This placed him in the 97th percentile for how far most children read at that age.
If you wish to support this AI reading and others like it, please visit patreon.com/askwhocastsai. Any help is appreciated. And thank you to executive producer John Doe 7776059.